This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Northwest Indiana Partners for Clean Air just issued a Business of the Year award to Metro Recycling for its efforts to be a good steward of the environment. We talked at length with Metro's CEO, Neil Samahan, about the award itself, about a number of other topics, too, including the U.S.-China trade situation. But first, he tells us about what Metro Recycling really does.
Metro Recycling is a recycler of primarily metals, but we do take paper, not so much on plastic. Mm-hmm. The only plastic we would take would be PVC fencing and siding,
right.
But primarily metals. We're located in Blue Island, Illinois, but then in Northwest Indiana, we have facilities in Griffith and then Valparaiso. In addition to that, Metro Recycling also, there's sister companies, sister division, is Metro Auto Recyclers, and we have facilities in Valparaiso and then Indianapolis. And then that division, we buy cars primarily at auctions, and we're dismantling those cars to resell the parts that are on the cars that are still usable. So it's not, you know, it's recycling, but it's actually reuse, right? So we're trying to reuse the parts. And then what's left, we'll recycle and scrap out. I've been in business since mid to late 80s. Great run.
How do you feel that it's important for Metro Recycling to be a good steward of the environment, in particular with air quality, which is how you got the award from the folks there in Hammond recently?
Well, right. I mean, we're a company that is a recycling company, right? I mean, our whole mission, right, is to contribute, you know, a significant effort in maintaining a sustainable environment. And we take that seriously. So, you know, how we operate our business, and then the business as a whole of what we're trying to accomplish in terms of recycling. The more material that's recycling, I mean, the benefit of that is increased air quality because it's the reduction of emissions that's associated with, you know, mining or, you know, the depleting of natural resources. So anything that we do that can divert material and, you know, reduce the need for mining, that all contributes to a better environment, sustainable environment, which in turn, certainly helps in air quality.
How does the recycling effort that you do at Metro Recycling fit into not only the community recycling efforts all around Northwest Indiana, for that matter, but much of the entire Midwest?
Well, I mean, we're significant, at least in the Northwest Indiana area, in terms of, you know, not only do we serve. So I will say this. So you have, you know, typically most people that would listen to your show would have curbside recycling. So they're putting out their aluminum cans, which we do take aluminum cans.
Right.
But they're going to put aluminum cans or steel cans, glass, you know, paper in the bins. We really don't compete with that effort in recycling. We're thinking, you know, the item is bigger than the bin, you know, and outside the bin, what you wouldn't put in the bin, whether it's an appliance, exercise bike, a regular bike, stainless steel sink, those items that aren't readily recyclable or you can't throw in your curbside recycling, you know, those are items that we would take. In addition to that, I mean, it's not just your general, you know, homeowner. It would be and is, you know, quite a bit. You know, we see contractors come into our facilities that, whether it's electrical contractors, they're getting rid of their wire, or the plumbing contractors, their brass and their you know, copper tubing, fencing, aluminum siding, window frames. I mean, a lot of our customers are contractors that are discarding their scrap material, which would otherwise go into a garbage container.
Mm-hmm.
Look, any and every pound or ton of material that we take, has a significant impact to the environment. And then collectively as an industry, right? So if we just serve the Northwest Indiana region, just collectively as an industry, we serve, you know, the state of Indiana, we serve the nation. I mean, it's a significant industry in terms of what we're diverting and collecting. To then, you know, reintroduce into the manufacturing process. I mean, we are a key component to manufacturing because much of what we do, once it's processed, goes back into the manufacturing process, You know, we've got the steel mills here in Northwest Indiana, where, you know, for us, you know, all our steel that we collect and process is typically sent, you know, right here, you know, regionally.
Mm-hmm.
So helping other businesses. And then as far as some of the aluminums and copper, maybe more regionally.
When you set up a collection system, as you have already in the companies, based on that system, and you mentioned here about the markets, in particular, steel stays typically here in Northwest Indiana, and the other metals that you happen to collect go elsewhere. How important has it been to either create or to maintain the markets for the materials that you will happen to collect, not only at the centers, but where people bring in?
So it's been actually right now. It's I would say it's a very challenging time in the recycling industry. We are enjoying market levels which are certainly conducive and encouraging of recycling. Recycling really is a factor of markets. The higher the value of any of the metals, really does encourage more recycling. Some of that is because of the process that are occurring, whether it's construction, demolition. The demands of the products is certainly going to increase the price, and that in turn increases the rate of recycling. So we've enjoyed, with some of the activity in the steel markets with the tariffs, I mean, that has increased the value of steel, which has increased the price of scrap steel. As far as some of the other products, when you take a look at aluminum, plastic, paper, we have been affected negatively because of what's happening in the markets, primarily related to China and some of the trade issues. It's quite a challenging time, even though the prices right now are decent.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a big trade issue currently going on.
Now, since you mentioned before that since you're dealing primarily in metals, but you have these other commodities that you happen to collect as well, and you're getting off to market by other means here, you haven't had the problems with the metals as far as overseas shipments are concerned, but I'm sure that you probably have some impact, or you know of your colleagues elsewhere in the industry that have had some serious impact because of the trade embargo, the tariffs, of the tariff problems that have been happening over recent years, I guess, overseas in particular, and the impact on the United States. But now we have the new administration's proposed tariffs for steel and the like, and how that's affected materials leaving the United States to go overseas.
So short term, right, like I said, the value of steel has increased, which thus the price of scrap steel has increased. However, we have seen, you know, with the introduction of some of the tariffs, if anybody's paid attention, one of the first acts of retribution, I guess you would say, that came from China was a 25% tariff on scrap aluminum going to China, which I think, you know, certainly underscores the significance of our industry in the world of trade.
Mm-hmm.
We move a significant amount of material overseas in terms of our recycling efforts. I would say I think it's just under 30% of the scrap material, and that includes scrap steel, copper, brass, aluminum, paper, you know, the whole likes.
Mm-hmm.
Just under 30% of what the United States processes is exported. About 40% of that used to go to China. Mid-year last year, and this is even before some of the trade issues, mid-year last year, China came out with a policy known as the National Sword, which went specifically to mixed paper and plastic, on which they banned going into China. Now, if you think of what you put out on your curbside, generally when people are putting out their recyclables and they're putting the paper in that blue bin, as well as the plastic, the paper is called mixed paper,
right?
The grade. China has banned that material going into China. So they announced this as of July of last year, that this would be effective in January. But with the time it takes to ship and so on and so forth, you could pretty much say that effectively started July 1. back in, I think it was either August or September of last year, the value of mixed paper reduced by 40%. And that was the initial price drop. Today, if you take a look at a published number, now that's just kind of where the basis of where the markets would be. It's kind of like, you know, if you look at the stock market or COMEX or LME, where they trade metals and so on and so forth. Today, a published price for mixed paper is $0 to -$5 a ton.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's, you know, what it's, quote, unquote, selling for, but pretty much, right, because you've pretty much knocked out the market, you know, in China, and that same goes for plastics. There are actually some areas within the United States that have had to look to landfill some of those items because there is no market. And I know this has occurred specifically in some places in Oregon and some other places where they can't find a market. There's not enough room to store this material, and it's ultimately needing to be landfill.
Yeah. I get the impression that those of us here in the Midwest are better off than folks on the West Coast because it's historically always been that the materials that get to the West Coast get shipped overseas. And I imagine that even with China out of the picture now, that they've had to do some very fast shuffling to make sure that their other overseas markets material can go to.
Well, and certainly, you know, long term, you know, the thought would be, right, I guess, you know, conventional wisdom would say that there's going to be some people that look at this as an opportunity, and there may be some other markets forming.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in some areas there are, but it is still very disruptive, you know, in terms of what's going on, at, you know, day in and day out. This time around, though, I would say that, yes, it may have affected the overseas market, you know, or the markets on the coast. But it has significantly impacted the entire country. This is not just an issue of the coast, because there's still a lot of material that is exported out of the Midwest overseas. You know, the price to export is not prohibitive even within the middle of the country. A lot of containers come from China this way, and they're either going to go, and this was in the past, right? A lot of containers would come this way with goods, and ultimately became quite attractive and expensive to export back out. It was either that or the containers are going back, you know, empty to China. So there's a lot of material here in the Midwest that would also be exported. We don't do a lot of exporting, or we'll send it to, you know, other brokers, but we specifically keep most of our material, you know, locally. However, there are some items that are more purchased out of Asia, out of China, and progressively, if you take a look at what's happened, you know, the first announcement back in July on, you know, mixed paper plastic, this is only getting ratcheted up. It's now, by the end of, I think, 2018, they're no longer going to be taking electric motors, there's a couple other, I think, wire. And then by the end of 2019, or I think actually by the end of 2018, they're no longer even going to take post-industrial plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the end of 2019, primarily the only items that would be going to China will be copper, aluminum. We don't send a lot of steel that way, scrap steel that way, but it'll be basically reduced to that. So there's going to be, it's very disruptive. It's very concerning. It has affected the markets. And a lot of people are scrambling. And if you take a look at the whole scrap aluminum, there is, you know, some specific grades that, you know, immediately, you know, if they don't have a big market here in the States or other areas, where we're negatively impacted by, you know, one day all of a sudden our product is worth 25%, you know, less.
Right.
Not on all aluminums, but, you know, there's certain grades. And this is what's making it quite difficult.
Well, Neil, do you think that even despite all these changes, disruptions, as you've mentioned, in how the markets have been set up here, that you've typically been able to use for years, do you think it's going to have any real impact on Metro Recycling's business, the future business, perhaps?
You know, that's what everybody's wondering. How is it going to impact us, and what do we need to do to stay ahead of it? What do we need to change? You know, what new markets do we need to find? You know, do we process differently, more? You take a look and review your entire business and see what you have to do differently to adapt to the markets. Recycling again is in general it's a market driven business. I always ask people if I'm doing any sort of presentation, ask them what makes something recyclable. A lot of people will mention, some sort of scientific process, so on and so forth. And really the answer is there a market for it? Whether or not it has recycling symbols underneath it or two, whatever the case may be, just because it says it's recyclable, if there's no market for the material, it's not, in fact, recyclable. There has to be a market. There has to be a place for it. So even though we're in the recycling business, we always emphasize, we believe there's always going to be enough items to recycle, but we always try to emphasize that recycling is the last R and reduce is the first. It's reduce, reuse, and recycle.
That's right.
So how can we reduce what we're discarding, primarily first? What can we do? If we take a look at some of the plastics specifically that we use, is that really necessary? Do you have your own water bottle? Do you have your own... whatever the case may be, even if now if I go to a restaurant, try to become more conscious of, no, I don't want a straw. And you just kind of take a look at the things you do every day and see how can I have an effect, even as little as it is. I mean, specifically with the plastics, it's becoming more and more, I think, pronounced to the negative impact that plastics are having on our planet, and if the markets aren't there to recycle, we have to change our behaviors. The items that are very highly recyclable that will typically always have some considerable value, are going to be those items that are, steel, copper, brass, those items, aluminum. They may fluctuate, but there's always going to be some level of a market that should still promote recycling. It will make the job difficult, if the prices come down or if there's less of a market, or again, you've got to find new markets, but there should be enough value there that you can continue on. And those companies that can adapt will survive, and certainly, some that can't, won't. And some of it will just be, attrition because of the difficulties to be in this business. Again, we've been around since mid to late 80s. We think we're doing things right, and we try to adapt to every challenge there is. And we've had several along the way. Again, it's a market-driven business, very, very perilous at times, a roller coaster. But, we've adapted. We're also in a service industry, right? We are here to fulfill a desire for the residents of Northwest Indiana to recycle. We are set up, our facilities are set up in order to serve those people that want to recycle. We have clean facilities. We have, I think, great individuals that serve these people that come visit our facilities in a polite and serving manner, again, to assist them in what they're trying to do. And we try to do that in an environmentally friendly way, because it'd be ridiculous if a recycling company isn't doing that. It kind of goes against what they're even trying to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how we've been recognized, by the PCA, that we have made, great efforts. A couple years ago, we actually, through the PCA, we were able to have an open house here at our Valparaiso facility, where, our larger auto recycling facility is. That facility is both a general recycling center and then also our auto facility. But we had an open house, and we had some folks from IDEM, from the Secretary of State, local folks, business people, some other folks related to environment, and opened up our facility and gave a tour, and we enjoy doing it. We open our doors and say, here, this is what we do, how we do, and I think that matters. I think the residents of the communities that we're in, appreciate that if we're going to be a business that is a recycling industry, we should conduct our business in a way that also promotes sustainability and how we operate. So, for our Metro Auto facility back in 2010, we received IDEM's Indiana Clean Yard Award. In addition to that, it was considered gold level. So basically, you know, they came to our facility, and IDEM is the Indiana Department of Environmental Management.
Right.
They came to our facility, took a look at our best, you know, management practices. They inspected our facility, saw what we did, and then also was given gold level, which basically says we go over and above what they require in operating, you know, this facility. And back in 2010, there was an excess of 500 licensed auto recyclers in the state of Indiana, and there was only 10 that had received IDEM's Indiana Clean Yard Award. And at that time, only 7, I believe, had received gold level status.
Wow! Wow!
Something that we're very proud of. I mean,
well, certainly.
It you know, it's sometimes we're looked upon as a the old view of what we do in terms of a scrap yard or an auto junkyard, and that's not the case anymore. You know, really, we're a recycling facility. We do it in an environmentally friendly manner. In 2010, we planted 400 trees around this property, did a lot of landscaping. There's some plans to do some more, you know, later on this year, because we don't want to. We are not, that old junkyard that you might have seen in the 60s or 70s or whatever the case is. This is a very clean, high-tech industry and business anymore, at least, you know, those of us that operate it that way. And we're proud to be part of the communities, and Metro is very engaged, you know, with the communities. We're very supportive of the park districts. Wherever we can, because basically our success is dependent upon the acceptance of our business within the communities. And I think that's really where we try to strive to do, or what we try to strive to do, is be engaged, be a part of the community, put ourselves out there, because, you know, again, we believe we provide a service, because a lot of people are environmentally conscious. You know, the people that go to the parks and enjoy the parks, whether, you know, it's where I'm at now at our Valpo facility, whether it's the Valpo, you know, Valparaiso parks or the Porter County parks, or we planted some trees in Griffith. The folks that are enjoying those parks are typically those that care about the environment, and that's where I think our industry, our business, goes hand in hand with, you know, what they're looking to do. So again, we try to do it in a friendly, environmentally sustainable manner, and engage with our communities and provide them that outlet.
Well, Neil Sanahan, thank you very much for spending time with us, with the great work that has been done with Metro Recycling, picking up awards here and being good stewards of the environment, to say the least, as well as doing their best to be a good participant in business in Northwest Indiana. Thank you for spending time talking with us today about this.
Thank you very much, Chris. Appreciate the opportunity.
Neil Sanahan spoke to us from the Metro Recycling office in Valparaiso. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Journalist and author Sam Quinones was in Indianapolis recently to talk about his acclaimed book, Dreamland, the True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. The Methodist Hospital Task Force hosted Quinones, whose book investigates the how and the why behind the opioid epidemic. It's been praised by the national book critics. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan had a chance to sit down with the author last week.
You speak in the beginning about, you know, how this story really, really grabbed you, and you feel like you needed to do this book. Yes.
Right. I started the book really focusing on Mexican heroin traffickers, how drugs are trafficked. The DEA was saying they were seeing seizures increase at the border. I pretty early on collapsed onto one town in Mexico where everybody essentially came here and learned a system of selling heroin retail by the tenth of a gram or the gram, not very large doses, like pizza, selling it as in a pizza system. So basically, very similar to Pizza Larry. So you'd call a number, and they would arrange for a driver to drive the dope over to wherever you were. And this was a remarkable innovation in the underworld. That is a moment when another story is playing out that I didn't know anything about. I didn't know anything about healthcare or pain management or anything. And they hit the time when a revolution in pain management is underway in American medicine. massive promotion of narcotic pain pills and opioid painkillers as the pretty much cure-all solution for everybody in large doses.
It's the perfect storm in many, many ways, and you're right. Able to get at that from a number of different angles, and you explore that through the eyes of, you know, these great characters that you've found as well.
Well, I found that in order to tell a story about a downer, depressing topic like heroin, nobody wants to read about. You have to liven it. You have to give it a face. You have to make people part of the main focus of the story. And so I really spent a lot of time trying to find those stories.
Portsmouth, Ohio, a small town on the river, and the setting for Dreamland, a large, gigantic pool that is really a metaphor as you start the book. Why start there?
I started there because I thought that this was a story that was bigger than what I initially believed it to be, which is about drug marketing, drug trafficking, drug addiction. I have an entire book, and there's not one scene of someone shooting heroin into their vein. One reason for that is because it's a cliche. But also, I felt that the story was bigger than that. It was deeper than that. It was about community and how we have destroyed community in the country. And Dreamland Pool in the small town of Portsmouth, Ohio, on the Ohio River, was a perfect example of what we'd done. It was this gorgeous civic center, civic plaza of a pool. Everybody kind of grew up. Their first romances were there. And then the Rust Belt Syndrome sets in about 1980. A lot of factories leave. Main Street hollows out famously, as we've seen in so many towns. Walmart pretty much sucks up all that. Finally, population diminishes, and finally they couldn't continue with the swimming pool, and they dig it up and replace it with a strip mall. And with that, you know, the town loses something essential to its existence, I thought.
And here in Indiana, we're not immune, and we're actually right on the pipeline, as you point out.
The first place they come to is Columbus, and this would be in the late 90s, this one group of guys. Which is a remarkable thing to me. They were the first one to figure out and then systematically exploit the coming market for heroin that the widespread prescribing of pain pills represented, was going to create. And after that, they figure that out in Columbus, and they just follow the pills. They go to Nashville, and from Nashville, my reporting shows, from Nashville, this group expanded like a market, a territorial kind of thing, like any corporation or sales force would do. They'd come up to Indianapolis in the early to mid 2000s and begin selling here. And they've really been here ever since.
Thank you so much for coming in today.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan with author Sam Quinones. NPR News recently revisited a series earlier about the impact of the opioid crisis in Muncie, Indiana, and they interviewed Ball State University economist Michael Hicks for the story. Michael came on Regionally Speaking not long ago to talk more about the economic impact that the addiction problem has on families as well as on communities.
If you compare, for example, the loss of American lives nationwide, I think we counted 30,000-40,000 last year related to opioids. That's close to what we lost throughout the entire Vietnam experience of 1962 roughly to 1972. Certainly more than the combination of all the wars since then, and really much more like what a year, close to what a year, or at least 6 months of World War II would have been. It's actually a very, very, devastating loss to a community like Muncie, where the death rates from opioid addiction have gone from, maybe a dozen per 100,000, we're a county of about 125,000, to 50 or 60 per 100,000. That is very much like the World War I, World War II experience in Muncie, greater Muncie area.
I know that in the history books, when you read about the situations and the things that happened overseas during the war, and particularly in the First World War, because nobody really expected that war to be as devastating, at least not at first, as it turned out to be, that there were so many people back home that had felt this impact with the loss of family members as well as economic losses, too, that you can see why the comparison is there.
Right, just in the raw loss of lives. Of course, we're a bigger country now, but, again, I think we account for a full 56,000 lives lost during Vietnam, including training accidents that occurred, stateside and That's, you know, roughly similar to over almost a decade to a year, year and a half of the opioid crisis. And it's not evenly spread across the country. It's certainly not it's in every community, but it's not maybe as devastating everywhere in terms of the proportion of deaths and overdose, and the fiscal effect as well seems to be more concentrated than other drug episodes.
You talk about in the article, in your conversation with the NPR reporters about the economic loss. In what ways can such losses be measured?
Right. It's a painful calculus, but what most people think of, they say, well, you know, we think about the hospitalization costs or the costs of burying someone and maybe the costs of naloxone. And those are certainly non-trivial expenses, right? But the real cost is the loss of a life of productivity. I mean, this is striking young people, predominantly 20s and 30s, the loss of a lifetime productivity, the value of the services they provide as a member of a market economy, and then just also the effect that that has on families, their inability to care for children. Certainly Indiana is experiencing just a huge spike in opioid-related foster child demand. So, you know, just a huge increase in the number of children that are left without parents or without functioning parents. And those costs per person run in the millions of dollars, whereas, the cost of naloxone or the cost of treating somebody in a hospital are measured in the tens of thousands. So it's a much bigger effect, I think, than most people suppose before we start thinking about the, you know, less monetary consequences of heartache and the, you know, loss of a big portion of a generation in some communities.
What kind of work have you and your colleagues there at the Center for Business Economics and Research at Ball State been able to do in comparing the numbers that we talk about, and certainly the healthcare issues and the loss of lives and everything that's come about as a result of the opioid addiction crisis and the economy? What kind of the impact that it has on the economy?
Well, we're, I think, contributing to research that a lot of economists are now very interested in, and that's the effect of maybe fractured communities on healthcare outcomes. And these range from Ann Case and Angus Deaton at Princeton. He received a Nobel Prize for work that he did in chronicling, among other things, chronicling poverty and healthcare-related issues. And they noted a couple of years ago the increase in mortality rates or the reduction in the lifespan of middle-aged white Americans for the first time in a century that is clearly related to opioid use and drug addiction and this spike of deaths. And what we have done is study the effect of automation exposure, job risk due to the sort of organic changes that are occurring in factories and workplaces and the consequential health, self-reported health conditions of households. And we found a fairly strong correlation. The bigger the sort of regional risk of jobs going away, the worse healthcare outcomes tended to be, even when you accounted for, 20 or 30 other things that would otherwise account for. So kind of a shocking result related to the labor market, discouragement that I think a lot of Americans have been feeling for a decade or so.
Have you had a chance with you and your colleagues to get together and talk about these issues and been able to bring it closer, literally closer to home? In this case, we're talking about Muncie and Delaware County in particular, since the problem is everywhere in Indiana and around the country, of course, where there may be some instances where some people are aware of some of the impacts because of the opioid epidemic on the community in particular.
Well, this is something. Observing the real world is what informs our decision of what we research. And we typically run statistical models, but we're trying to think about what are the issues that are sort of plaguing our community or before our community. And working at Ball State University, there's no evidence of an opioid crisis or drug use, other than a little bit extra beer on a Saturday night like most campuses.
Right.
So we're fairly immune in this little bubble. But if you run down to the hospital, I've got two teenage boys, and so we've been to the emergency room a couple times in the last year for teenage boy-related orthopedic injuries. And in each instance, there was a heroin addict in the emergency room. and in the midst of an overdose, either unconscious or you know, suffering severely from overdose exposure, and that, you know, to have a 13-year-old who's there for a soccer injury, or a 16-year-old who's there with a, you know, breaking his ankle in tennis practice, those are things that most Americans are going to continue to experience as the crisis becomes more gripping and more, you know, the death rate rises. So I think when we asked in the emergency room, it was an everyday experience for them to have someone under the influence of opioids. And I think that's probably true in every hospital in every town of 50,000 people or more in the United States.
Are you noting as well, taking a look at the, sort of the historical view of this, about what we are seeing in the opioid addiction crisis that is gripping the country as well as the state of Indiana, in some notice to how it turned out that maybe this is a much, much worse situation than might have been, say, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, back in the 50s when it seemed to be that the crisis was dealing with heroin?
Right. So we talked offline before. I grew up in Washington, D.C., so you know, I'm old enough to remember the heroin, what we thought was a heroin crisis in the early 70s in the D.C. area, and you know, angel dust or PCP when I was a teen. And then, you know, it moved to, I was in West Virginia as a researcher in the turn of the century when OxyContin and oxycodone was the new drug and meth were the new drugs. All of those, you know, there's sort of two dynamics. As one drug goes away, some of the same users, or becomes less prevalent because of law enforcement or whatever, you know, some users move to the next drug. But the scale of the opioid addiction is much larger than any of the experiences we have seen before. And for a drug of this kind, right, obviously marijuana use and alcohol use are, you know, much more prevalent. But the sort of scale of a human toll, the effect on health, the effect on mortality are much different in the current crisis than we have seen before, and come with that, because of that, much more a bigger fiscal strain and much more fundamental and long-term economic consequences.
What kind of impact are you seeing, if there's any yet to see, because it's kind of early, I suppose, in this unfortunate situation, with the government funding and even the family resources trying to come up with the money to deal with the problems of the addiction crisis? Are we going to have, at least what you see, the help that Congress is supposed to be able to offer through the administration to be able to respond to the opioid epidemic?
Well, I mean, sort of two answers to that. At the end of the day, it's really fundamentally a local problem. Local, you know, the people who deal with this are going to be the local law enforcement, the city, the small town police department, the first responders, the healthcare providers, and you can provide some resources to support that, you know, to the federal level. But and the federal government has done that with naloxone, and states are doing that to sort of make it possible for very cash-strapped communities to have available some of those resources. You know, but ultimately, if this is something that's going to kill, you know, 50 out of every 100,000 Americans every year for a decade, and goodness knows how many more are close to death or you know, not functioning members of society as a consequence of it, then those dollars are going to be, nothing's going to prove, there's almost nothing we can spend to, you know, sort of fully mitigate or stop that. It's really going to fall on families, and I think Yuka Noguchi did a really good job of demonstrating the damage this it does to families and how it left, you know, elderly people bankrupt caring for children and grandchildren.
I know that last year when she started in on the series, the first of the series began, I think, back in November of last year, and then she's picked up an update now with the latest reports that have been on NPR, and we carried on Lakeshore Public Radio. But I know even back then was a concern about whether the organizations in the community, and particularly there in Muncie, that are trying to help addicts and people who are trying to recover from the addiction, to be sure how they're dealing with it. And I know that the updates are just as sad, I guess. Things haven't changed all that much, even with the organizations, the community organizations, that is, in Muncie trying to help people out.
Well, right. And I think we have to give some credit to, you know, the local faith community, the healthcare providers who are jumping in trying to fix this. But, you know, it takes a long time to pull the resources together, even in a community that has a strong, you know, nonprofit community that's focused on this. This is, the dynamic is very complex, right? And that's why we haven't solved the problem. We usually solve easy problems first, and harder ones are much more. But this is, it could well be part of a very complex healthcare related problem that's, you know, mental health issues that we don't do very well with. We struggle on everything from very benign healthcare issues to very complex ones. And if we're in communities where there are a lot of people who are not capable of working, and they fall back into opioid use, I mean, it's, you're going to see very deep geographic inequities that stress the fiscal environment in these places, right? So it's not like the problem is happening in the really, you know, affluent community. There are certainly some problems there, but the ones that have the most resources may well be the ones that are least affected by the challenges here.
Now, have you and the other folks there at the Center for Business Economics and Research been able to maybe set aside some time or some research efforts to be able to continue to look at this, or are you going to have to just kind of wait until the opportunities come up to be able to continue to study the economic impact of the opioid epidemic on everyday life, pretty much, in not only in Muncie and in Indiana, for that matter?
Well, we like to preserve the division of labor, so as an economist, I'm not going to get into what I think are, you know, anthropological questions. How do people find meaning in life, and how does drug or addiction affect that? We're a team of economists and sociologists, so we are acutely interested in things that are outside what most people would think of the typical domain of economics. You know, we're not just about the stock market. We care about, you know, is productivity affected? Do we have intergenerational damage to households because, you know, younger children are negatively affected as a consequence of this? So we're trying to study those things, but it takes time. It takes time to read what other scholars have done. It takes time to get new data. It's not just an opioid issue. It's an issue of other despairs, you know, deaths of despair or drug-related issues. So it's not just opioids. It could be alcohol. It could be diabetes is a result of people eating poorly because they don't have, good access to health care. And so right. I think it's a very complex question. We're one of many groups of people trying to answer some questions around it.
Well, it sounds like then that there's going to be an awful lot of work that's an investment, I suppose, in not only research time and effort, but in money as well to try to resolve the issue of the opioid epidemic across, in this case, in Muncie, as well as the rest of Indiana and the rest of the country. So it's going to be a topic that obviously you and your colleagues there at Ball State University are going to be following for quite some time, I would imagine.
I think so. We're not going to arrest our way out of this, and we're not going to hope our way out of it. So I think the public sector response and the private sector response is going to have to be a bit more vigorous and thoughtful in the years to come than it has been.
Now, since you had a chance to talk with Yuki Noguchi here during the original series that got started last fall, and it's continuing now through NPR, do you think that you're liable to be visited again by another team of staff from NPR News to get updates of what you've been working on?
Well, it could be. The NPR staff has been interested in our work in automation and job, you know, related disturbance over the past several years. We're going to continue that. And I think that fits into the challenges facing, you know, particularly the Midwest, where we have very large share of manufacturing employment. We have a lot of small towns. We have some really fast-growing, great places. And that mix of challenges and opportunities are where it's good for research to try to help, you know, I think, inform public policy. That's kind of what our mission is and what we at a public research university are trying to contribute.
That's Ball State University economist Michael Hicks commenting on the serious financial impact of the opioid addiction crisis. This is Regionally Speaking. Statistics show black men suffer disproportionately from diabetes and high blood pressure, among other health concerns. Indiana Public Broadcasting, Samantha Horton tells us that a statewide initiative is underway to increase awareness of health problems among African Americans, in particular, been visiting some very popular conversation points.
It's a busy Saturday afternoon at the Infinity Men's Salon just north of downtown Indianapolis. There are several chats happening in the shop, but amid the sounds of clippers and music, two volunteers sit at a table asking people if they want to participate in a free health screening.
You want your blood pressure, blood glucose check real fast?
Tracy Scott is a medical assistant and is checking blood pressure, blood sugar levels, and body mass index, some of the statistics that can indicate health issues affecting Black men.
In the Black culture, African American culture, high blood pressure, diabetes, being overweight, obviously that's very prominent.
She says she hopes bringing the screenings into a comfortable social setting will convince more of the barbershop's customers to seek preventative care.
You have a lot of people that walk in the door, especially on a Saturday. So, I mean, it's better than being in a clinic because you're not going to get as many people who've not been screened that walk into a clinic.
This is the eighth year of the Black Barbershop Health Initiative in Indiana. And these sorts of conversations have been happening all month as Black men get a trim or a shave.
You gotta get your blood pressure down, man. Take when you get done, man.
Nah.
It's only gonna take you, man.
Infinity Men's Salon Manager Richard Gladney has participated for several of those years and says he's encouraging all his customers to get tested.
The barbershop is like a cornerstone of our neighborhood and in the Black community. And there's always a stigma with Black, especially Black men, not going to the doctor. So for some of us, this would be the only checkup we get. And so it's a place that a lot of Black men come to. So it all comes together and works out perfect.
There are customers that turn down the offer, but eventually one approaches the table to get screened. 19-year-old Caliente Macklin sits down and rests his left arm on a table to check his blood pressure.
142/98.
It's a little high, which doesn't surprise him.
I did have a heart attack back in December. It pretty much puts me on my toes to be aware of my health, to make sure I'm in good standings, because I got other people depending on me, like family members, my fiance, my brothers and sisters.
Macklin's had uncles die in their 40s because diagnoses of heart disease came too late to be treated. So he's glad he took advantage of the screening. Macklin says he likes the initiative, but wishes it was more widespread.
I actually think it's a good idea. It should be in multiple places, because never know, there's somebody who wants to come by, wants to get their blood sugar checked, or wants to know if they're in good health standings, or just to figure out overall if their actual weight is their actual weight. So,
medical volunteer Tracy Scott says the screening also allows her to teach people about clinics nearby.
And then we also have some literature also that we hand out and showing people that there are free clinics in their areas that they can go to. A lot of people just don't realize that, they don't know. And information, knowledge is power.
Shop manager Richard Gladney says he's proud of the turnout and wishes the event could happen more often.
Once a year is definitely not enough, because it's only on one day and we're open 7 days a week. So there's a lot of people that's not getting the experience. So even if you continue to do it on a Saturday, which is good because it's a busy day, it needs to be more Saturdays throughout the year so more people can experience it.
3 o'clock rolls around, ending the 6-hour outreach. Looking at the final list of participants, about 20 people took part in the screening. That's a record turnout for this particular shop and a sign that buzz may be growing about the need for more health screenings. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
With another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Don Parker, who is the board vice president of the South Shore Orchestra, as well as the principal bassist. Don, welcome to Eye on the Arts.
Thank you, John.
It's been a little while since you've been here as a guest.
I keep showing up, yes.
Bet you do turn up as a bad, like a bad penny, yes, you do. So the orchestra is based out of Elbow.
Yes.
And you've been with it since its inception?
Yes, about 15 years.
Oh, yeah. It's that long now. Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. And you've gone from being like a chamber orchestra to a full orchestra.
Correct. We actually started out as a chamber orchestra, and about 10 years ago, we got requests to do our first of our several China tours, and that they asked us to bring a full orchestra for that. And so ever since then, mm-hmm. we have been a full orchestra, but also a kind of a rep company. So mm-hmm. we do small ensembles, concerts, and that sort of thing as well.
Yeah. And you personally, as a musician, you're also affiliated with the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you've provided the music for numerous musical theater productions.
Community theater in the area, yes. Uh-huh.
You keep busy. And do you get paid for any of this?
Some beer money, basically, yeah. Uh-huh. You have to want to do it.
Yeah, you have to want to do it. Well, that's great. So, and I assume your fellow musicians in the South Shore Orchestra, this is similar. It's similar for them.
Yes.
Okay. Well, so how many concerts do you usually do a year?
Three concerts a year, usually. There's usually the spring concert, a fall, and then some other thing that we do. In previous years, we've had like a Veterans Day or a Christmas concert, and I think we're going to do a Christmas concert this year as well. Uh-huh. And this year, we are also, a small ensemble from our orchestra is also doing the music for Sweeney Todd at the Opera House in the fall.
Yeah, oh, that's great. So you typically perform at Memorial Opera House.
Yes.
And this next concert you have coming up is on Friday the 1st of June.
Yes, absolutely.
Tell us about it.
So it's an all Respighi concert. Ottorino Respighi was an Italian composer from the early part of the 20th century. And his two most famous pieces are The Pines of Rome and The Fountains of Rome. And we have those two pieces. Those are both major works in themselves. And mm-hmm. we also have a piece called Chanconne for Violin and Orchestra, which is Respighi reworking a much older piece. He was a scholar of Renaissance music, and this work by a fellow named Giovanni Vitali, who lived in the 1600s, mm-hmm. was reworked for 20th century instruments and 20th century ensemble.
Mm-hmm. And you have a guest artist performing with you.
Violetta Todorova, who has performed with us before, a violinist and a very gifted young woman from Eastern Europe.
I remember flying into Rome thinking, oh, so, you know, it looked like the Midwest. Oh, no, those aren't just trees. Those are the pines of Rome.
They are.
Oh, and there's Rome. And it doesn't look anything like the Midwest. Well, you know, it was jet lag.
It's a museum with traffic is basically what it is.
The Fountains of Rome differs from the pines in what way would you? How would you describe
it? I actually am not that familiar with either of the pieces except to play them. And so both of them are supposed to be.
That's pretty familiar.
Both of the pieces are supposed to be musical representations of, in the case of the fountains, specific fountains like the Trevi Fountain and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And in the case of the Pines of Rome, the pines of various neighborhoods of Rome.
So what's next then after this concert? What's next on the agenda for the Social Orchestra?
I think there is this particular year's schedule. There's nothing until our performance of Sweeney Todd at the Opera House in October. And then again, we'll do a Christmas concert. Oh, I'm sorry. I left out one. We have we do children's concerts at the Opera House every year for second grade students from the area. Partnership with them, and those are on May the 23rd. We'll do Peter and the Wolf.
Oh, sweet.
And that is open to the public if you wanted to buy a ticket, but uh-huh. preference is given to the students that are coming.
That's wonderful. Well, what is it about Sweeney Todd? It is an extremely popular musical among Northwest Indiana theaters.
I think it's because you're rooting for the bad guy. 15 minutes in, you find that you're rooting for a mass murderer.
Yeah, and it's been playing in The Village, New York, recently at the Barrow Street Theater forever. Mm-hmm. And, people just can't get enough of Sweeney
Todd. It's creepy, and it's fun.
Yeah. I love the thought of Angela Lansbury.
Exactly.
What is her Lovett? Mrs. Lovett?
Mrs. Lovett.
Yeah, that's great. Well, all right, Don. Thank you for being here to tell us about your upcoming Pines of Rome, Fountains of Rome concert. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And if you happen to miss any part of this conversation, you can go on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and check out Eye on the Arts there. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.